This podcast is brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Keep Joy on air by becoming a member, a subscriber, or donate. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.
Welcome to The Informer, Joy 94.9's nightly news and current affairs program, and your link to the stories that matter. We are committed to bringing you the day's most important news and current affairs stories from an LGBTI perspective. If it matters to the LGBTI community, we will cover it. We want to hear from you. Join the conversation, SMS 0427 Joy 949 or email on air at joy.org.au or follow us on Twitter at The Informer Joy.
Hey, I'm Daniel Roberts, your host on tonight's Informer.
And I'm Lara Dickinson. On tonight's show, we talk to Felicity Marlowe, who is one of three people taking the government to court over their recent plans for a postal plebiscite.
We cross to the Cook Islands to discuss a draft bill that will decriminalise homosexuality, and I talk to some of Australia's queer film experts about the state of LGBTIQ cinema in our country. But first, on Monday, Australia's LGBTQI community was disappointed by the Liberals' decision to put off a free vote in the Senate on marriage equality. Instead, they revived the idea of a plebiscite. Predictably, the Senate today knocked back the plebiscite-enabling bill for a second time.
The government's plan B was to hold a postal plebiscite. It's been revealed today that the votes will be posted from September 12th, and all responses are to be back by November 7th, with the results revealed on November 15th. This plebiscite's been criticised for being non-binding, non-compulsory, expensive, inefficient and unnecessary. It's also potentially illegal. Felicity Marlowe, the president of Rainbow Families, is one of three people alongside MP Andrew Wilkie and Shelley Argent who are challenging the postal plebiscite in the High Court. It's important to note that she is doing this as a private citizen and not as a representative of Rainbow Families.
Felicity Marlowe, you're one of three people who will challenge the government in the High Court. That's a really big responsibility to take on behalf of all LGBTI Australians and people who support marriage equality in this country. Why are you taking on such a huge responsibility?
Yes, I came up here, on behalf of Rainbow Family and Say No Plebiscite, and I live in Melbourne and I have my partner Sarah of 17 years and three primary school age kids. And when this opportunity to stand up and say we just can't go any further came up, when we saw that the government had made that sort of flippy-floppy non-decision on Monday night and then followed the news all day yesterday, it became clear that should the original plebiscite bill be voted down, that the postal vote is very much first and foremost on the government's agenda as a way forward. And I just really feel personally as a mum and as a parent that I couldn't go back to Melbourne and say to my kids, well, I haven't really tried everything I could try, but I've done my best. Because I don't think just letting them get away with having a postal plebiscite is the answer. So it is a big responsibility. I haven't ever done anything like this before. I haven't told my parents yet. I think this is a really big... It's an opportunity, and we need to take this opportunity on. We need to say to the government they just cannot have a postal plebiscite. The impact of it will be too devastating.
And the government has indicated, I mean, now that the plebiscite has the... mandatory plebiscite has been voted down in the Senate. The government has indicated it wants to do a postal vote as early as September 15, which isn't a lot of time, I guess, to challenge it. And we are still very much in the early days. So I appreciate there might not be a lot of clarity around this yet. But what can you tell us about this High Court appeal? What does it actually mean and what might it do?
Well, I understand that the... papers will be filed tonight or tomorrow and more details will be there. But from my personal reflection on the conversations people have been having in the media and commentary over the last sort of week or so when this postal plebiscite came up as a much more obvious pathway the government was going to take, is that there's several concerns. I've read articles saying things like that the Bureau of Statistics collects the statistics and does the census. Is it up for something? magnitude is the question that's being asked, a question that relates to statistics or not, is another thing that I've heard mentioned. So there's a myriad of different concerns that people have talked about, and I think a variety of those are kind of what will be presented when the papers are filed in the court tomorrow.
Has your counsel sort of given any indication what kind of time frame we're talking in terms of challenging something like this? Because, you know, high court challenges can drag on for a while. Is there the potential for that to happen in this, like, challenging the postal plebiscite?
Well, having not done this before, I'm not 100% on how they work out timelines and who gets to have a go in the High Court or not. But I would assume that given we know, I think it's September the 12th actually is the day that we'd start receiving ballots in our letterboxes, then we have to sort of work backwards from that and think about printing and the question and organising all of the infrastructure. So my understanding is that this will be a quick, short, sharp presentation, and that it will be within the High Court within a week to 2 weeks.
Right, so hopefully it will at least put the brakes on a little bit until everybody can sort of get their heads around what's going on with this postal plebiscite. And look, I think I can confidently say on behalf of most LGBTI Australians, nobody really wants a postal plebiscite on this issue. But as an advocate who's working closely with a lot of other prominent advocates on this, how would you tell someone, what is your argument against this? Why are we fighting a postal plebiscite?
Well, aside from the very obvious arguments against a postal plebiscite that people have been making, the time wasting, the lack of certainty about the binding nature of it, that it's voluntary to participate, we looked at the 2015 referendum in Ireland. While that was successful and a fantastic opportunity, they had to have a referendum or a public vote because they were changing their constitution. So we spoke to Rainbow Families last year, sort of a year on from that victory, and talked to them about what the impact of the public campaign had been. And it was really clear from talking to those parents and to some of the children as well that it's had a lasting impact on their mental health and well-being. The fact that people could stand up and, covered by the idea of a public sort of debate, were able to philosophically and theoretically discuss the merits of same-sex parents, whether they were good parents or not, whether children were being looked after properly. And those sort of arguments that are the ones that really concern me. They're the sort of things that I worry about. I worry about what letters are going to fly will appear in my letterbox in my street, not just that my kids will read, but the people in my street will read. And will they start to think about me and my partner and our ability to parent? Will they look at our children a bit more closely and worry that, you know, will people look at that information on the flyer and then look at our family and start to question our children and our parenting? So that's what worries me. That's what keeps me up at night, I guess, and that's really why I'm involved.
And even a few days into the resurrected debate about a plebiscite, we know that people have been affected by this. So we do encourage anyone who is feeling unhappy or is concerned about their mental health surrounding this discussion, do call the switchboard on 1800 184 527 to get any help that you may need. Felicity Marlowe, a lesbian mum from Melbourne, thank you for all that you've already done for the community, but for this massive battle that you've taken upon yourself with a few other people to fight the postal plebiscite.
No worries. Hopefully I'll speak to you in a few weeks with a victory.
That was Shannon Power speaking with Felicity Marlowe. It's 6:41. This is The Informer on Joy. With the postal plebiscite now a possibility, there are concerns around the time it takes to become enrolled with the Australian Electoral Commission. The AEC were unable to speak on air today, but they passed on these instructions.
So people can check their enrolment, enrol or update their enrolment details online at aec.gov.au. You'll just require appropriate evidence of identity. All Australian citizens aged 18 and over are eligible to enrol. 17-year-olds can also provisionally enrol so that they are ready to vote when they turn 18. If you don't have online access, however, you can pick up a hard copy enrolment form from the AEC office or Australia Post outlet.
My name is Valentino Wichman, otherwise known as Valerie. I am the secretary of the Tetiare Association of the Cook Islands, which is the only LGBTQI association in our country. Currently, I am the lead campaigner in our fight towards decriminalization of homosexuality.
The Cook Islands is made up of 15 islands scattered across the South Pacific. The population of 21,000 people is deeply Christian, with many holding traditional values. But Valerie and the Te Tiare Association have been working hard to make LGBTQI equal in the Cook Islands. The Parliament is reviewing the country's Crimes Bill, which is in serious need of a revamp. Passed in 1969, the bill is being updated to reflect the 21st century. One law that needs to change is the country's ban on homosexuality. Even though no one has been convicted of homosexuality, advocates recognise the need to have the law removed.
The starting point was probably 2 or 3 years ago, and one of the big areas that we wanted to work on was decriminalisation or changing certain provisions in the Crimes Act. We actually launched it on the night of our Miss Jewel pageant, together with the Free and Equal campaign of the United Nations. Since then, we sort of had a strategy. So what's happened now is we've managed to get a select committee established to look at amending provisions in the Act. The submissions close at the end of this month or next month. And so at the next sitting of Parliament, they will either vote for or against. Yeah, that was the hard part of
Joy,
it.
Joy 94.9.
Personalities, people's ideas, people's misconceptions. I think the biggest part of it, or the biggest backlash, was the misunderstanding of the campaign. A lot of the backlash was from a religious sort of area within our society, and they had a lot of push against it because their view was that it was about marriage equality, which was not the case. Our campaign was to first decriminalize and maybe in the future work towards marriage equality.
While Valerie and the Te Tiare LGBTI Association are quietly confident that the law banning homosexuality will be abolished, they have faced stiff opposition during their campaign.
I think it was really necessary for us to put in the hard yards to try and change it, because in terms of opposition, there were two camps. The first camp, which was people saying that they didn't want it because of marriage equality, and the other camp that said, who cares about this law because it has never been used, so we shouldn't even look at it. For us, because it's not a problem, it should be taken out or amended as such.
Some of the arguments sound similar to ones we're hearing here in Australia about marriage equality. But in the Cook Islands, the fight for decriminalisation is just a first step in securing the human rights of LGBTI people. Valerie explains what the next fight is, if and when homosexuality is decriminalised in the South Pacific nation.
Yeah, so I think for us, in terms of, I guess, the legislative framework and the policy framework of the country. Firstly, we've been focusing on decriminalisation. But working alongside that, we've also been trying to change the national gender policy to include sexual orientation and gender identity, because the current national gender policy only has male and female. So that's something that we want to focus more on. We know that that current policy is going to be reviewed at the end of this year. So I guess it'll be in time for us to move from the decriminalization campaign into sort of the policy area, which will influence everything else.
This is The Informer, Joy 94.9's nightly news and current affairs program, and your link to the stories that matter.
Every year, festivals come and go. Every year I say to myself, I'm going to go to that, and I usually only ever make it to the pop-up bar. This year, I was determined to be a true festival groupie, so I've been spending my nights at the Melbourne International Film Festival, or MIFF, as it's affectionately known to us festival regulars. I was so glad to see the high and varied amount of LGBTI content featured in this year's festival, and it got me thinking about Australia's own history of LGBTI stories on screen. Well, maybe I was overreacting. So I spoke to film critic Glenn Dunks and Lawrence Barber from the Star Observer about what this means for the LGBTI film industry and asked them, are we headed into a new era?
I don't know if we're entering a new era in terms of quality, because I think the LGBTQI filmmakers kind of always been able to make really great films. But now we're entering a period of filmmaking where these filmmakers are able to use a broader canvas.
That's a very complicated question. I'd say that we're in something of a new era in the sense that there's more access for people who want to tell queer stories than there has been before. In Australia, for example, because most of the films made here are government-funded films like Pulse, which was made by an Australian, Daniel Monks, can actually get funding because there's a desire for those stories to be told. And having films like Call Me By Your Name and BPM, God's Own Country, and those kinds of films, both playing festivals and getting theatrical releases, kind of shows that there is an audience for those films. And that's kind of the most important part in terms of getting more stories told, is showing that people actually want to see them in the first place.
These two seem to really know their stuff, so I was curious to find out why some queer Australian films have done so well locally and internationally.
I think that's something that's very much happened over time. Australia's queer cinema is kind of there, but it's also made rather sporadically. And these days, I think in recent times, they tend to be very small, very independent films. They don't tend to get the bigger treatment that some Australian films get. And I think that television is sort of a slightly different matter, where they're taking a bit longer to actually catch up, especially comparative to the rest of the world, where TV is kind of the main place that queer stories are being told in the media that people are really engaging with.
So, for example, something like Priscilla, which did so well, and, you know, still does well. Is that kind of film, because it has that sort of Aussie nature of rooting for the underdog, is that something that's more likely to resonate with an Australian audience?
I think it is. But at the same time, I think Australia is in many ways forgotten to make films, how to make films like Priscilla. That was such a, I'm not going to call it a flash in the pan success, but it was very much an overnight success. And I feel like it's a formula that both the people involved creatively and the industry at large haven't had much success recapturing. And I'm not quite really sure why that is, but that sense of humour and that openness and that wildness that film embodied so well, beyond just its queerness and its camp value, it's maybe a bit out of fashion in some ways, and that it isn't kind of the respectable image of queer people that is so often the one preferred by executives and certain storytellers.
It was almost like Priscilla was a breath of fresh air. It was just something. It was something that came along that people hadn't seen before. And whether it's about a subject that for many back then and still today is, you know, very controversial and people don't like to talk about, people still like to be entertained. And I think that was one of the really brilliant things about Priscilla, is that while it confronted lots of very powerful issues head on, it did so in a way that audiences just responded to. They like to laugh.
So, we all like Priscilla. We got it. What about an example of where Australia got it wrong?
Probably one of the worst is a film from 1988 called The Everlasting Secret Family, which its audiences would probably be right in having no idea that this film even exists, because it very much came and went. But it's a film about a secret society of gay men who use private schools as a breeding ground for dependent house servants.
Oh, I know those guys.
Yes. Yeah. It's such a strange movie. Not even just because the plot is particularly absurd, but because it's very offensive. Not just because it, you know, positions all gay men as either disgusting creeps who, you know, lecherously bring boys into a harem where they are just, yeah, they're literally their house boys. But it suggests that gay men, was all they wanted is sex. All that they are about is pedophilia, really. Mm. It's really a revolting film.
Shocking.
And I can believe that it got made in the 1980s. I'm kind of glad that it is rightfully been scrubbed from the earth.
So obviously all those filmmakers have come out of obscurity to great or not so great success. But what if I wanted to make a film, where would I start? Queer Screen in Sydney is an organisation dedicated to telling queer stories on screen. I spoke to Queer Screen's director, Lisa Rowe, to get the lowdown on what they do and how they support the community.
That's an excellent question. Queer Screen is a not-for-profit organisation based in Sydney, and what we do is we put on two film festivals a year, Queer Screen Film Fest in September and the Mardi Gras Film Festival in February, which is our large festival, which has been around for what will be our 25th year coming up to this February. So we not only do that, but we also have a bunch of initiatives that we do to support local filmmakers who are making queer content. We have My Queer Career, which is our Australia's largest film prize for short filmmakers who are making queer content. And we also have a completion fund for features and documentaries and web series that we started a few years ago that gives funding to emerging filmmakers who are making feature films and things like that.
What inspires me about queer filmmakers is the courage these people have in creating and distributing their own work. I asked Lawrence and Lisa for the best ways to go about this. So if I'm a young, undiscovered, or it doesn't have to be young, but if I'm an undiscovered queer filmmaker, how do I get discovered? Where do people see my work?
I mean, one of the ways that queer stories are really reaching people now is through web series. And there's a degree to which you sort of have to find your own way in terms of making something like that. But at the same time, funding bodies in Australia are getting much better at seeing the value in web content and the reach that that has. There are so many web series. There are many Australian queer web series that people are making and lots of people are watching. They're usually crowdfunding their resources. So there's a direct relationship between the people who are actually telling the stories and the people who are consuming them. And that's something that's really important. It's also very kind of fundamental to how queer art has always been made, is that we make it, it's made for us and by us. And so that's a really good avenue to go down, and it's definitely leading people to bigger opportunities from there.
Lisa, if I were an undiscovered queer filmmaker in, say, regional Australia, what advice would you give me on how to get started?
That is a good question. Well, I would assume most people, they start making a short film. So I would suggest that you make a short film and then you submit it into our festival. So we have, My Queer Career, I think I mentioned it before, was our short film competition. We had last year, I think, a record number of entries. I think we had 46 entries. We only actually selected, I think, about 11 films to actually screen in competition. But we also have other avenues and things like that. If people are an emerging filmmaker, we run a lot of networking events and things like that. So every festival, we put on what's called a speed networking event. So if any, we have any festival guests from internationally or locally, we'll come and, like a director or an actor or a writer, will come and speak. And then we have some networking for local queer filmmakers to meet and form projects out of that.
Like I said, there are so many queer films playing at this year's Melbourne International Film Festival, but I was interested to know if my guests had a favourite Aussie queer film. Let's hear from Glenn first.
A film from 1988, directed by Vincent Ward. It's a New Zealand-Australian co-production. It's called The Navigator.
Mm-hmm. In the sense that it was a film that made me realise my sexuality, and it's a classic film, I think, from 1996, called Love and Other Catastrophes.
I mean, we've already talked about it. It's Priscilla.
Oh, fantastic.
I will give a slight second play, only barely, to Muriel's Wedding, which I choose to read as a queer film.
There is still more to come on Joy's The Informer, the news program from an LGBTI perspective.
And that's our show for tonight. Daniel and I would like to thank Felicity Marlowe, Valerie Wickman, Lisa Rowe, Lawrence Barber and Glenn Dunks for being on tonight's show. We'd also like to thank our executive producer, Shannon Power. My name is Lara Dickinson.
And I'm Daniel Roberts. See you tomorrow night.
Thanks for listening to another Joy podcast, brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Help us keep Joy on air. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.